set for this morning is Estate of Robert Lynch versus Kevin Lynch. We have Michael Schaefer, who's appearing on behalf of the appellant, Estate of Robert Lynch. And we have Pamela Ryder appearing and Ron Parsons, who will be arguing on behalf of Kevin Lynch as appellees. With that, Mr. Schaefer, you may begin your 15-minute initial argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, it's my privilege to appear today on behalf of the estate of Robert Lynch. The estate in this case appeals from a motion denying its motion for partial summary judgment from a order granting Kevin Lynch's motion for judgment as a matter of law on a joint account and from the final judgment entered in this case. The question presented in this case is whether this court should overrule the precedent it established in Benash v. Moeller in 2006, in which this court has followed and approved as recently as 2019 in the estate of Stabner versus Huther. In Benash, this court established a bright line rule of substantive law that no oral extrinsic evidence may be admitted to justify self-dealing or to raise a factual issue in a claim for breach of fiduciary duty under a power of attorney. This court has consistently held that a power of attorney must be strictly construed. This court has also consistently held that if the power to self-deal is not specifically articulated in the power of attorney, the power to self-deal does not exist. In this case, the power of attorney did not contain a provision authorizing self-dealing. The power of attorney contained one provision authorizing limited gifts consistent with and up to the limit of the federal gift tax exclusion, a power that Kevin Lynch admitted he never used. Yet, in this case, the trial court ruled that Kevin Lynch was permitted to offer oral extrinsic evidence of his alleged agreements with his father and his father's approval of each and every one of these transactions. In essence, the court ran into the teeth of the bright line rule established in the court, essentially said, well, it's admissible to show whether the fiduciary duty was breached.
Counsel, you know, it appears that one of the primary issues here is the disagreement between the two sides here as to whether or not there were transactions conducted by Kevin that were outside or without the necessity of using the power of attorney, the joint checking account in particular, which was formed after the power of attorney was executed. Can you address your view as to why you think those transactions, that all of those transactions are still subject to or were being undertaken with the power of attorney?
Kevin Lynch admitted in his testimony that all acts he engaged in dealing with his father's property were done pursuant to the power of attorney. That's on page 124 of the transcript. He also admitted under oath that all of the checks that he dispersed from of his father's funds that were in that joint account was done pursuant to the power of attorney.
But is that a factual determination, or is that really a legal question of whether he's using the power of attorney?
Well, I think it's a factual determination, and he can't claim a better version of the facts than his own testimony. He's essentially tried to claim in this case that, oh, there were acts outside of the power of attorney, but he's never identified what those acts were. In other words, all of the claims that we've brought in this case, the claims, for example, he wrote checks to himself for $398,000 between 2011 and the date of his father's death, March 13 of 2018. Those were all gratuitous transfers. They were all for his benefit. He admitted he used the funds to pay off his own loans, his own debts, and to pay his own bills and expenses. So those were absolutely transactions prohibited under the rule of Benash. Yet he was permitted to offer oral testimony without corroboration, without witnesses, that his father agreed to every one of these transactions. In fact, he said, well, my father, I don't have any witnesses because my father and I discussed these in private outside of the presence of any witnesses.
Outside of those particular transactions, what about the others that related to the purchase of farm equipment and other things that may have pertained more directly to the farming operation?
Well, the purchases, okay, we have essentially a claim on our motion for partial summary judgment was for the $398,000, approximately $106,000 that he used to establish two Morton buildings on his own property, and $45,000 approximately that he took out of CDs, investments of his father, to buy a pickup for himself. The money, approximately $104,000 that he used of his father's funds, was to purchase farm equipment after his father was retired. His father retired in 95, was no longer involved in the farming operation. After January of 2012, there was no farming operation because the land was cash rented to the Solomons. There was no need or use of this equipment. And furthermore, it all redounded to his benefit because under the terms of the will, he received all of the livestock and equipment that was left after his father died.
Counsel, is there any record evidence that he was aware that he was a 51% beneficiary under the will?
He admitted.
So he had seen the will?
Well, okay, here's what he says. He claims he never saw the will, but before the reading of the will, he told his sister he had seen the will. So his own admission to his sister Anne was that he had seen the will. Furthermore, the evidence was the will was written in 2010, March of 2010. Shortly after that, he removed all of his father's belongings from his father's safe deposit box, took him home to go through. And the original will was never produced. Mike McGill, the attorney for the estate, admitted a duplicate original of the will that he had in his office. So I think there's pretty good evidence that he knew what was in the will. And he admitted several times that he knew that his father had told him he was going to be a 51% beneficiary of the real estate.
Mr. Schaefer, if returning to that conversation that you were having with the Chief Justice about factual nature of what sort of authority Kevin Lynch may have been operating under, a co-owner of an account versus an agent under a power of attorney, and if that is a factual determination, does the fact that we have a general verdict in this case that doesn't specifically through interrogatories or otherwise designate some sort of determination in that regard impact our ability to review that error?
First of all, Your Honor, his status as a joint account holder doesn't entitle him to take those funds for his own benefit. He admitted that the money that belonged in that account was his father's. Under a South Dakota statute, it's presumed that the money is on a joint account belongs to the person that contributed it. Those funds belonged to his father. It was his father's money in there. In Wyman versus Bruckner, the same issue was presented to this court because the person came in and said, hey, I signed that $200,000+ worth of checks to myself and my family as a joint account holder, not as a power of attorney. And this court held, no. You breached your duty as a power of attorney when you took that money and gave it to yourself and your family. The court specifically rejected that argument that a joint account holder had a different status when they were also serving as a power of attorney. So I submit that this court's already addressed that issue in Wyman versus Bruckner.
Well, Mr. Schaefer, I want to differentiate, though, between the legal showing of a breach of fiduciary duty and the evidentiary rule of does this evidence come in to prove whether or not they're self-dealing. And so the breach of fiduciary duty, that was really all that was addressed in Wyman. The evidentiary rule was not addressed. So if we go back to Benash and the evidentiary rule in that case was, if you use a power of attorney, we're not going to let you put parole evidence in of any conversations that you had with the principal. What case can you cite that we've applied that evidentiary rule outside of a power of attorney, for instance, a joint account where you're writing checks or some other fiduciary, even if it's a fiduciary relationship, have we applied that outside the context of the exclusive use of a power of attorney? In what case is that?
Well, I think Wyman addresses it because in Wyman...
But that's not an evidentiary rule in Wyman, isn't it? That's a question about breach of fiduciary duty.
It's a question about breach of fiduciary duty, but it's also a question where the fiduciary tried to claim, I didn't write these checks under my power of attorney. I wrote them as a joint account holder. They tried to make, and this court said, no, you breached your duty, your fiduciary duty, when you wrote those checks to yourself, just regardless of your status as a joint account holder. That's what the holding in Wyman is.
So let me ask you, and I want you to assume for a moment that our ruling is, if you use the power of attorney under Benash, the evidence doesn't come in as to any discussions with the principal. But if you use a joint account, it does. I want you to assume that that's what our current law is. If that's the case, can that be applied consistently in every case?
Well, I guess I'm not following because first of all, the court in Wyman said that those funds belonged to Mom that were in that joint account. In this case, Kevin Lynch admitted that the funds in that joint account belonged to his father. So he's taking funds that belong to his father when he's his father's power of attorney, and he's using those for his own benefit. Once he takes them for his own benefit, there's a breach of fiduciary duty as a matter of law. And that's why the motion for partial summary judgment should have been granted on the claims that we brought on that one motion. Now, in this case, Kevin Lynch seeks to bring himself within a narrow exception this court recognized in Hine versus Zas. In that case, Fred Zas, first of all, there was an order in limine precluding any oral extrinsic evidence of his mother's intent for him to self-deal. And this court held that that order and motion was properly granted. The only issue in Zas was, with respect to the fiduciary duty, was Fred Zas testified he had a pre-existing relationship with his mother. His brother had the same relationship. The practice over the years was that he got to use the family, his mother's land, rent-free. And this court acknowledged that with respect to a pre-existing relationship or pre-existing state of affairs that existed before the power of attorney came into existence, he should have been permitted to testify that he had this prior relationship and that what he did as consideration for it was to take care of his mother, which he did for 20 years. She lived with him for 20 years. And that was his evidence of good faith. Even this court said there's a good faith requirement when you have a conflict like that. But furthermore, this court also cited the cases that have went from Benash forward in South Dakota that an agent can't do anything that a fiduciary is prohibited from doing. Fiduciary is prohibited from self-dealing, from profiting, from the use of trust property. So is any agent, particularly one here that works under a power of attorney. Now, all of the conduct in this case was none of it predated, that we're bringing claims on, none of it predated the power of attorney. Now, Kevin Lynch tries to bring himself within some broad claim that he was in a partnership with his father that continued up until his father's death. That's not true. Kevin Lynch was in a farming partnership with his father from late 70s to 1995 when his father retired. After his father retired, he rented his father's farm ground on a 60-40 crop share basis. So he was in a leaseholder relationship with his father up until from 96 to 2011. From 2012, the land was cash rented to the Solomons.
Your time is out, Mr.
Okay. Chairman. Thank you.
Mr. Parsons, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court and my good friend, Mr. Most of the cases that gave rise to the Beinash Bright Line rule involved fact patterns where a more distant relative or even a non-relative, a neighbor, befriends and ingratiates themselves to an elderly person near the end of their lives and secures a power of attorney. And this case is the polar opposite of that. Kevin and his father, Bob, were about as close as two persons on earth can be. They worked together farming the family land and raising their crops and cattle together for their entire lives, sharing that work and responsibilities together. Best friends their entire lives, spent every day together, along with Bob's wife and Kevin's mom, Mary Imelda. She passed in 1999. And after that, Bob and Kevin pressed on together alone for another 20 years. And Kevin was the only one of Bob's three loving children who was there to take care of him and be with him every single day as he aged. The Beinash decision and every case that this court relied on in establishing Beinash, Crosby from Nebraska and Profke from Wisconsin and Kuniwa from Hawaii and on, all involved an agent using a power of attorney to give himself admitted gifts or other gratuitous transfers, like changing the beneficiary designations on accounts or creating a right of survivorship. And the agent then claimed, well, I had the power to give myself gifts under the POA. And anyway, he told me I could.
So, Mr. Parsons, it sounds like you're arguing the evidentiary rule is really not a bright line rule. It may depend on the facts.
Well, I think it may in some cases, but here I'm just saying this falls clearly outside of the bright line of Beinash.
Well, but you've got a POA used by Mr. Lynch. He used his POA to cash out, what, two or three CDs, put $40,000 into his account, bought a pickup in his name, in his name. So wasn't that a use of a power of attorney?
It's a question of fact as to whether or not that's self-dealing.
Well, that's a different question than the first question is, does that evidence come in as to his explanation of why he bought the pickup? The first question is, the court's the gatekeeper under Beinash,
right,
whether that evidence comes in, isn't that? And so he used the power of attorney. Seems to be no dispute about that. That's what the documents show. Put the money into his account, wrote a check. Why doesn't Beinash apply and the evidentiary rule apply at least to that transaction?
It doesn't apply at least to that transaction because of this court's holding in Beinash. And this court's holding was you cannot use a power of attorney to self-deal, give gifts or gratuitous transfers unless it's clearly and unmistakably expressed in the POA. That's part one. Part two is you cannot use oral extrinsic evidence to show that you had the power to self-deal, that there was an intention that you self-deal. But if it was not self-dealing, And there's a question of fact as to whether it was self-dealing, and that is a question of fact, as this court just said a few weeks ago in Johnson versus Markby. It falls outside of the Binash bright line rule.
But how do you create a question of fact if the evidence doesn't come in?
That's the
if Mr. Lynch's evidence of, you know, here's what the arrangement is I had with Dad, here's the discussions with about the pickup. If none of that evidence comes in, how do you have a fact question?
Well, it does come in, Your Honor, is what I'm saying, and it ought to and must, because Kevin's not saying I have the power to self-deal. He told me I could self-deal. That's not the question at all in this case. Every single transaction is something he did for his father's benefit. That's what the evidence shows. And the evidence was that pickup was needed so his father could get out of the nursing home. His father could not get into a larger truck anymore. He had to get out of a wheelchair, smaller truck. His father would have been confined to the nursing home and could have visited the farm he loved had that truck not been purchased. That's why it was purchased. It was not purchased to self-deal for Kevin's benefit at all. And that's why, because there's a question of fact on that issue, it doesn't even come within the realm of Binash's bright line rule. Nothing should be overruled in this case. Binash is there where there's a question, where there's admitted self-dealing or undisputed. This was self-dealing. And all of this court's cases where it's enforced by Nash without exception involved, yeah, I was allowed to give myself gifts. Sure, I wrote myself checks to do that. I was allowed to. He told me to. I was allowed to benefit myself. Nothing Kevin did in this case was intended to benefit himself in any way.
Is it that easy, though? Is it that easy for someone in Kevin Lynch's position to simply say, well, there was also benefit to the principal in this case. So there was also benefit. Is that too convenient? Is that, you know, for instance, did he give the pickup back after his dad passed to the estate? Did he give some of these other things back that his claims were motivated by some, you know, altruistic motivation for his father? Or is it otherwise? Did he, in fact, benefit to some degree, if not exclusively?
Well, it's not a question of altruism. The power of attorney expressly authorized everything that Kevin did in this case. What he did was he made sure there was an arrangement where all the non-tillable acres, the 80 acres of pasture land, the homestead, the fencing, the roads, all of that, he did that physical work for 8 years while his father was in the nursing home. And Ann admitted at trial, of course Kevin's entitled to be compensated for all of that. She just wouldn't agree to an amount. So all the things he did to make that happen are not gifts. At least there's a question of fact as to whether or not they aren't. They are or they're not. The power of attorney authorized him expressly to do all of that. That was the purpose of the power of attorney. All these equipment transfers that Ann labels as self-dealing were expressly authorized under provisions 4, 5, all these, to take care of the farm, to take care of those 80 acres. He bought those things to do what he had to do to take care of his father's property. Still a substantial cattle operation going on, and you know all these 80 acres of land he's taking care of. That's he spent all of his days doing that work, and admitted that her father would want Kevin to do it, and from that not to be hired out. So all of these things and all the equipment was in his estate when he died. The only thing not in his estate when he died was the truck, Your Honor.
The Morton buildings look a little different, don't they? They weren't those put onto Kevin's land?
They're owned by the estate. They're still in the estate today. They were put on his land, as the evidence showed, because there was not only flooding on Bob's homestead, and this was to protect all the equipment that they had already and that they purchased over the decade or so, you know, as they replaced it. It was to protect it. And after his dad moved to the nursing home, no one was on Bob's homestead living there. And so there had been break-ins and burglaries, and they were afraid someone would just break in and steal all the equipment. So Bob and Kevin talked every day, discussed every decision they made about the farm and the equipment, and they decided the most prudent thing was to put the equipment on Kevin's land, or the buildings on Kevin's land, and store the equipment there. Kevin's there. There's no flooding issues. He uses it, brings it as needed to his father's farm. And the Morton buildings, and those can be moved. They're owned by the estate today.
Was there evidence that
Go ahead. That
related to him using funds from the joint account to pay off his own loans or expenses?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, that was, but it was compensation he earned for doing 10 years or 8, 9 years of labor. He had his full-time job to take care of this property. And what he did was, his dad needed cash flow desperately in order to make sure to have the certainty he had cash to pay his $500,000 in nursing home expenses. So they had to change their relationship as it evolved. And instead of Kevin making a profit of $60,000 a year in the first year after he agreed to this fee, he lost money. He went from making money on the crop share arrangement. It was about the first year a $65,000 decrease of his tax returns, but that was offset by he got a $30,000 fee, and the only way he was able to put himself in a position not to work and to accept such a reduced income was to start off with having his equipment loans cleared up.
So the rule that prohibits oral extrinsic evidence that the principal authorized the agent self-dealing, despite the absence of that authority and the power of attorney, seems to recognize the evidentiary advantage that an agent has in litigation like this, where the principal has passed away and is unable to confirm or deny some of the details that you're describing right now. So that seems to be the virtue of the rule. And even when, bright line or otherwise, even when we have maybe not seen it as brightly in certain cases, we've still accounted for it. And we've still noted its value as a rule that neutralizes that advantage. But we found justification in other ways that allowed us to, as I say, maybe not apply the brightest version of that rule or to not apply it at all. In this case, what justifies, in your view, or accounts for that evidentiary advantage that's inherent in a case like this that can give us confidence that we don't need that rule?
In every case where this court has applied Binash, it's because someone had said, I had the power to give myself gifts. I had the power to write myself checks as gifts. And in fact, he said I could do that. I had the power to change this account to benefit me. And in fact, he told me how to do that. Kevin didn't give himself a single gift, didn't change anything on any accounts. What Kevin did was make sure that the farm continued to operate and purchased equipment so that it could do so. And Binash and all of the cases that apply it, and I've come to accept Binash is needed for these cases where there's no doubt it's self-dealing. But when someone cannot just come in and look at transactions and say, I think that's self-dealing. I want to label that as self-dealing. And all because that accusation is lodged, an evidentiary wall goes up, and the person trapped on the other side of that wall then is prevented from explaining what he or she did. That's not what Binash is for. Binash is for when someone says, no, I'm entitled to give myself gifts. He told me I could give myself gifts. There weren't gifts in this case. There was compensation given and expenditures made to take care of the farm, all of which were authorized under the POA. That's what he's supposed to be doing under the POA. And even for terms of the truck, Section 20 of the POA expressly says you need to provide for the automobile that I'll be able to ride around in. He did not give himself gifts. And actually, this is the rare exception of a POA that actually does authorize self-dealing gifts up to the IRS limit. He could have written himself a check for $14,000-$15,000 every year and said, this is my annual gift. He never did that once. He wasn't interested in gifts at all. He was interested in taking care of his father's property and working every day to do that. And that's what he did. And admitted he's entitled to compensation for that.
So what I hear you really saying, because I don't think Binash says exactly what your argument is here today. I think you're suggesting that maybe that bright line rule ought to be adjusted based on the particular circumstances of the case, and that it may not be equitable for the court to say, we're just not going to let that evidence come in this case. We're going to exclude it completely and not allow a principal to put on evidence, even though the attorney, in fact, even though the principal may be deceased. I hear you saying that maybe that rule is too harsh in some instances.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. But the court said in Bronson, this is a quote, but these legal principles do not apply here because Butch did not seek to admit oral extrinsic evidence to show that he had the power to self-deal. That's exactly the same. Kevin was not trying to admit this evidence to show his dad said, go ahead and self-deal. That's not this case at all. We're way outside the bright line in this case. Kevin did everything he did, or at least viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to him, certainly, and the jury certainly believed that Kevin did everything he did to benefit his father. He was not putting his own interests above his father's, which is self-dealing. And it's a question of fact as to whether he does that or not, as this court just said in Johnson versus Markby and has always said, Hein and all these other cases. He didn't do that. He took care of the farm. He bought equipment for the farm. He put himself in a position to be able to do that and be paid for that and reduced his income substantially to his own detriment and his father's security and benefit in order to do that. And to say, Kevin, why did you write that check? Objection, sustained, fine, Ash. Kevin, why did you do, explain yourself, why did you do what you did? Objection, fine, Ash, sustained. This is not what Binash was intended for at all. This case falls well outside the bright line rule. I welcome, and I'm not a, you know, a fan of bright line rules. Juries are asked to decide, make credibility determinations in every single case. We need them in some cases, and Binash is good and needed for these admitted self-dealing cases or these cases where they're trying to say, I had the power to self-deal. He told me I could self-deal. That's not this case at all.
So do you think Kevin enjoyed an evidentiary advantage in this case in the absence of Bob's testimony that could have either confirmed or dispelled?
No, Your Honor. I mean, there are cases where people pass away. I think the truth enjoyed an evidentiary advantage in this case. And jury or trials are about a search for the truth. Binash was not intended to inhibit the truth-seeking process. And it should not be used that way or applied that way. When the evidence is, the question of fact is whether there's a breach of fiduciary duty, whether there's self-dealing. If that's the question of fact, you have to admit all the relevant evidence on that issue so the jury can hear both sides' evidence.
Mr. Parsons.
Thank you, Your Honor. We ask that you affirm.
You may proceed with rebuttal, Mr. Schaefer.
Mr. Parsons argues these weren't gifts. He also argued in his, well, in Stabner, which this court applied the bright line rule to, it wasn't a gift either. It was a transaction for less than value. In Binash, this court said specifically, because of the manifold opportunities and temptations for a general power of attorney to self-deal for his own benefit, a rule, and it quoted from a Hawaii court decision, Kunawa, a bright line rule needs to be established. This court has followed that rule consistently, even in Smith Angus Ranch, which said that bright line rule doesn't apply where the fiduciary is acting under a corporation. His status as a fiduciary is because he's an officer in the corporation. But this court still held that it applied in powers of attorney cases because of the acute vulnerability of powers of attorney for self.
Which wasn't present in Smith because of the statutory structure that would govern
right.
Conduct of corporate officers or fiduciaries.
And what he's arguing here is basically there's no bright line rule at all because I get to come into court and use oral extrinsic evidence, what my father, who's now dead, told me I could do, to prove that I didn't self-deal or that my father approved of it. I mean,
well, I think, you know, what I heard opposing counsel to say is the question is whether, in fact, there was self-dealing is the fact, not whether he had the power.
There's no question of fact as to whether there's self-dealing here because he, and I'm looking at the Wyman case, Your Honor, which you brought up, where all these checks were written to family and herself by the power of attorney, says these transactions involved Morris's property during her lifetime and directly benefited Bruckner. given our precedent, it is apparent as a matter of law that Bruckner breached her fiduciary duty. And then they cite Benash and Stout for that proposition. So self-dealing occurs when somebody uses their principal's funds or property for their own benefit. It's undisputed. That's what happened here. He took that money of his father.
So the question really is, was the self-dealing improper here? Was there a breach of fiduciary duty? And the issue ultimately is, what evidence should come in to make that
determination? Your Honor, on that pickup case, they're not entitled to offer oral extrinsic evidence to justify buying a pickup and putting his name. Not entitled to offer oral extrinsic evidence to justify building these Morton buildings on his own land. As a matter of law, when he engages in self-dealing, which he did here, and there's no fact question about self-dealing. I mean, he engaged and used money and property belonging to his father for his own benefit. That's self-dealing.
And so you're asking, in those instances, really, you're saying, let's take Benash beyond just the power of attorney. If he's writing checks out of a joint account, that we've got the statute, a presumption that it's owned by dad, he can't write those checks out. And can't put on oral evidence to explain.
Exactly. He can't do that.
You want to expand Benash.
I don't want to expand it. Benash stands for the proposition that you can't create a factual issue in a case involving a breach of fiduciary duty under a power of attorney.
Well, but that's putting it backwards. If you're saying there's already a breach before you decide what evidence can come in, isn't that backwards?
No, because you're creating a factual issue saying that it comes in on whether there's a breach. I'm saying, based on this court's precedent, it's holding in Wyman, it's holding in Benash, when you use principal's funds for your own benefit or do something for your own benefit, such as change accounts to POD that you can inherit, that's a breach of the fiduciary duty as a matter of law.
What if there was a benefit to both he and his father with some of these transactions? Does that matter?
Well, I don't think it matters, because you can always come up with some nebulous claim that dad wanted me to do it, or he thought that was a good idea, or he somehow benefited from it. But you're still using oral extrinsic evidence to justify that.
To determine whether he breached his duty.
You're using oral extrinsic evidence to, I don't think it's admissible to determine whether he breached under the Benash holding.
So is self-dealing mutually exclusive with arm's length or purported arm's length dealing with a principal? Can he answer that?
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, it is, I think it is mutually exclusive with self-dealing, with some arm's length. Furthermore, this court said, if you want to do this, you have to have a writing. In Stabner, they tried to introduce an affidavit that says Mr. Stabner saw this contract and agreed or approved it. And this court said, regardless of whether he saw it or verbally agreed or approved it, there's nothing in writing. Benash says you got to have something in writing to support that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. I want to thank both counsel for your arguments. This case is now submitted. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.